I don't know about you, but over the last week, as the rupee has touched a historic low, I've been inundated with people sending me their old and notorious tweet from Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. If you haven't got it or if you've forgotten it, here's what he said. This is before the Prime Minister was elected. He said, when Mr. Modi comes to power, the rupee will be 40 to the dollar. It was a crazy thing to have said then, and it seems even crazier now because the rupee is at 77 something and it's worth nearly half as much as Ravi Shankar and various other Modi fans said it would be. People sent this to me to indicate what a bad way the economy was in. Others pointed to what was happening in Sri Lanka. That was the work of a nationalist government, they said, which had made all kinds of nationalistic promises and had driven the country to bankruptcy. The same thing was going to happen in India. It's just that we in the media were covering up. Now, look, I'm not an economist. I'm not an expert in Sri Lanka. But even to me, that sounds over the top. You cannot compare the Indian economy to the Sri Lankan economy. And there is no way we're anywhere near what's happening in Sri Lanka. Yes, there may be problems with the economy. It is nobody's case that the economy is doing extremely well. But no, we're not heading down that way. But, you know, when you talk to people who are critical of the Prime Minister, you hear many such arguments. If you speak to them, you realize just how polarizing a figure Mr. Modi has become. In the eyes of his supporters, he's like God. He can do nothing wrong. In the eyes of his critics, however, he's the worst thing to have happened to India in several decades, and he's leading us to damnation. I've been trying to work out why Mr. Modi is such a polarizing figure. I've spoken to the people who are against him, and I've listened to their reasons. One, as we've seen, is the economy, which I think is overstated. The other one is that Mr. Modi is too dictatorial. He is too autocratic. This may well be true, but you know, the way it works in Indian politics is that if you can win an election for your party single-handed, then you really don't have to worry about what anybody else says, let alone the people in your party. It's always been like that. It's exactly the same as it was when Indira Gandhi was in power. She'd won power for the Congress. She did what she wanted. Mr. Modi's won power for the BJP. He does what he wants, and he doesn't care what anybody else in his party says. So I don't think that's much of a criticism. Other criticisms? Well, that he's misused the agencies, that political opponents are targeted. I think that's fair. There's no doubt that that's happening. But it's not without precedent. Remember Narasimha Rao? Remember how he used the CBI to frame L.K. Advani? Remember Devegowda? How he used the agencies to target all his political opponents? Yes, what's happening now is worse, but it's not exactly unusual or novel. And then there's the criticism that he has muzzled the media. That's valid. I think many people in the media who were Rottweilers when the UPA was in power are now eager to please poodles. That's the way the cookies crumbled. That's the way the media has changed. But can you blame that only on Mr. Modi? Is it without precedent? We had the emergency, of course, when journalists were locked up, the media was censored. And we've had other occasions. Mr. Vajpayee had publications critical of him and their owners raided. Rajiv Gandhi filed scores of cases and had lots of raids against the Indian Express. There is a long and dishonorable tradition in India of people targeting the media, particularly people in power with something to hide. So yes, I concede all of those criticisms, but I don't think they are enough or valid enough to explain the sort of derision with which Mr. Modi is regarded. So you ask yourself this, we can understand why people love Mr. Modi, they believe in him, but why do people regard him with so much derision? Why is he so polarizing? Now, the more you talk to people who are critical of Mr. Modi, you realize that though they may cloak it in terms of the economy or China or foreign policy, that's not what they're really complaining about. What they're really complaining about is something much more fundamental. They believe that Mr. Modi's government is rewriting and reworking the very basis on which India was founded. They believe that what he is doing is against the spirit of what Gandhiji, Jawaharlal Nehru, Vallabhbhai Patel, many, many others of the Indian independence movement, people like Ambedkar who framed the constitution, it's against the spirit of what they wanted. Let me explain this. We forget this now, but there were many ideas of India around the time the constitution was written. The idea of India that predominates today was certainly the most popular one. It's the one that the freedom fighters believed in. Gandhiji, Panditji, Bose, Vallabhai Patel had differences. About the one thing they were all agreed on was the need for an India that was pluralistic and secular. That changes when you come to the Hindu Mahasabha, RSS line of thinking. The RSS had a completely different vision of India. If you go back and you read what RSS leaders and thinkers wrote during that period, some of it so embarrassing has been disowned by the RSS now, there is stuff that I think would cause serious concern. Some of it is sort of very generous to Hitler, which is why those bits have been deleted from RSS books. But a lot of it is about the kind of India they wanted. They wanted a Hindu state. They wanted a state that was essentially Hindu, where if other minorities stayed, they could stay as guests of the Hindus or people whose position was secondary to that of Hindus. That was not the vision of India that prevailed. It was very much a minority vision. The vision that prevailed was one which said that Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, everyone has an equal stake in India. It's not a Hindu country. It's a secular country. A secular country not in the sense that the people don't have a religion, but in the sense that the government treats all religions equally. Critics of Mr. Modi argue that what his government has been trying to do is to reinsert and reassert that minority RSS view of India and to try and abolish the view of India that was the view of the framers of the Constitution. Now, it's difficult to know whether this is accurate or not, mainly because of Mr. Modi's own statements. If you listen to Mr. Modi's speeches, he very rarely talks about Hindu-Muslim issues. Very rarely are there any communal statements in any of his speeches. When he talks about other things. He appears sometimes even to celebrate India's diversity. On the other hand, the people who follow him, his ministers, his chief ministers, people in his party, follow a completely different path. What they say is much more in keeping with what Guruji Golwalkar and the other RSS leaders said about India at the turn of independence, around the time the constitution was being framed. I'll give you an example. I think many people in the RSS believed then that India had been suppressed for a long time in years and years and centuries of Muslim domination. They wanted a reversal of that situation. They said, for instance, and perhaps they were right, that in Mughal India, Hindus were not equal citizens. They lived in peace, maybe, they went about their business, but there was no doubt that the rulers were Muslims. There was no doubt that the Muslims had a more elevated place. And in many cases, Hindus were even taxed for the simple crime of being Hindus. So that was not a desirable situation, surely, but it's one that many in the Hindu right want to replicate with the roles reversed. They want Muslims to feel as Hindus must have during that period. They want Hindus to be the new Mughals. Once you sort of accept this obsession with rewriting history, with changing the balances of the past, then much of what the Hindu right has been saying makes a lot of sense. Last week, the Delhi BJP said it wanted to change the name of Humayun Road, change the name of Akbar Road. It didn't want anything with a Mughal connection or with a Muslim connection. If you look at the names of cities, you can't say Allahabad any longer. That sounds too Islamic. You have to say Prayagraj. You can't say that the Taj is a wonderful monument if you're part of the UP government. You have to either play it down or you have to, if you're a lunatic, say it's actually a Hindu palace that Muslims took over. There is the emphasis on making Muslims follow Hindu ways. The argument being that we were made to follow Muslim ways when the Mughals were in charge, so let's do it now. So a Muslim cannot eat beef because he's living in a Hindu country. A Muslim, or anybody for that matter, cannot keep a meat shop open during a Hindu festival because Hindus don't eat meat during our festivals, and so on and so forth. Now, it's not clear that Mr. Modi subscribed to any of these things. He doesn't actually necessarily always object. And when things go too far, like for instance, when the cow lynchings went really far, sometime, a safe period after it was over, he came out and condemned violence in this regard. But it is equally clear to anybody who lives in India that there is an attempt to change the consensus. an attempt to make this much more of a Hindu country it's ever been, an attempt to make Muslims feel more like second-class citizens than they've ever felt. Now, you have to ask yourself, why are they doing this? Why is Mr. Modi doing it? Is he doing it because it has majority support? I'm not sure it does. As Prashant Kishore never tires of pointing out, the BJP never wins a majority in this country. It often doesn't even win a majority of Hindu votes. You can win an election quite easily in India with 40% of the votes. 60% may still be opposed. And there are very few elections in very few states where Hindus have voted overwhelmingly for a Hindu agenda. Besides, are they voting for a Hindu agenda? If you are to follow Mr. Modi's election campaigns, these issues don't come up. He does not say, elect me and I'll stop people from eating beef. He doesn't say, elect me and I'll change the name of Allahabad. The agenda is unspoken. So it's not even clear that anybody has voted for this agenda. And would they vote for this if this agenda was out there, if people were asked to vote for it? I don't know. There's no evidence to suggest that they would, which is why elections are won on the strength of Mr. Modi's personality, some little raising of communal temperatures, but no saying that we are going to change the whole character of the Indian constitution. So you got to ask yourself, why is he doing this? Why does Mr. Modi do this? Does he need to do it? My view, and this is purely my view, is that given the state of the national opposition, even if they didn't play this, we'll change the name of this and stop beef eating there, that kind of agenda is not necessary. Even if they didn't do that, the BJP would still win the election. There is really no opposition. So why is he doing it? It's possible he's doing it because he believes in that. I mean, he's a man who joined the RSS at a young age. Perhaps he just buys into that vision of India, a vision of India that's completely at odds with the idea of India that was launched in 1947 with this country and re-emphasized in the 50s with the constitution. Maybe he just doesn't believe in it. Maybe he has more in common with Golwalkar than he does with the others. And you've got to ask yourself, finally, the big question. That is, if we keep going down this path, can India continue to flourish? Can it continue to survive even? Will the world look at us differently? Will at least a part of the world turn its back on us? And what about the minorities? Will they silently acquiesce in their own marginalization? Or will there be some kind of unrest that follows? I don't know the answers to these questions. Perhaps you do. Certainly, they're questions we should think about.